We're just happy that it's a schedule that we can work with, we can live with, and that does not adversely impact the project.
Alaska's LNG project gets a revised timeline. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, March 13th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, an unexpected change of fortunes in this year's Iditarod.
I mean, we were rolling coming into Ilim up those hills, and I decided just to keep on going when they were doing so good.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The Alaska Commission on Post-Secondary Education offers the Family Education Loan so parents, a spouse, or grandparents can help students with the cost of college or training programs in or outside of Alaska. Interest rates are lower than the Federal Plus, and no credit is required. For more information, call 800-441-2962 or visit acpe.alaska.gov/radio. This message sponsored by the Alaska Commission on Post-Secondary Education.
The federal agency responsible for studying the environmental impact of the Alaska LNG project has released a timeline for completing its review. The Federal Energy Regulatory Commission announced today that it plans to release a draft of the final environmental impact statement in a year. If they stick to that schedule, they could authorize the project as early as March of 2020. The state was hoping to get through that permitting process and begin construction next year, but Alaska Gasline Development Corporation President Keith Meyer says the corporation can still bring the project online by 2025.
We're just happy that it's a schedule that we can work with, we can live with, and that does not adversely impact the project. So we're pretty excited about it. Today was a big day for us here.
But not everyone is as excited about the environmental review with such a quick turnaround. Erin Whalen is an attorney with Earth Justice. She says the environmental review timeline needs to be scaled to the project.
And this is a huge project. It's going to affect tons of communities across Alaska, and you know, getting input from communities in Alaska takes time. In any community, it takes time, but in Alaska in particular, it's tricky to ensure that people have been fully heard on a project.
One community is already weighing in with the Federal Commission. Valdez Mayor Ruth Knight sent the Federal Commission a letter today saying there should be further study of the wetlands impact. The Federal Commission has already ordered the state corporation to study Valdez and the Matanuska-Susitna Borough as potential alternative sites for the mega project. The state corporation is still looking for customers for Alaska's gas and for partners to help finance the $45 billion project. State troopers have released the names of the four officers who drew their guns in a fatal shooting. The shootout happened last week in the small village of Pilot Station when a domestic assault devolved into a tense standoff with law enforcement and ended with the suspect's death. KYUK's Teresa Katsourilis has more.
Trooper Darren Cooper, Trooper Charles Withers, Investigator Shane Colt, and Investigator Curtis Vick were sent to Pilot Station as backup. The trouble started in the village last Wednesday afternoon when Dwight Heckman, age 27, allegedly attacked his girlfriend. The trooper's report on the incident says that Heckman struck and strangled her, then dragged her into the street. He took out a handgun and shot multiple rounds into the ground near her body. Then he swung himself onto a snow machine and drove away. Multiple witnesses heard the shots and reported them to the troopers, but the closest trooper post is a village over in St. Mary's, and a dense fog in Pilot Station delayed air travel. The first responding officer got to the village by snow machine on Thursday afternoon. He found Heckman four-wheeling through town and tried to stop him. He says that Heckman put his handgun to his head and ran into the woods. Heckman fired several shots at the trooper a few hours later, and at this point, the troopers were already arranging to send backup.
We didn't know what was really going on, but we heard some shots every now and then during the day. And I wasn't sure. We weren't sure who was shooting
Abraham Kelly is the mayor of Pilot Station. He says he didn't know something was happening until the village school was put on lockdown on Thursday afternoon. The experience was both nerve-wracking and confusing. The village police officers and troopers never took the time to tell him what was going on. Kelly says that some people in the town didn't know there was a lockdown and went on about their shopping. By Thursday night, village police officers were on the VHF, telling residents to get inside and lock their doors. They had secured a perimeter near the stretch of woods that Heckman had escaped into, behind the village post office. Backup arrived in the village by plane and snow machine, including a SWAT-style special emergency reaction team from the Anchorage area. Law enforcement tried to contact Heckman. Community members heard a volley of gunfire. Troopers Cooper, Withers, Colt, and Vic fired their service weapons. They found Heckman dead in the woods an hour later. The shooting left Abraham Kelly with unanswered questions. He's known Heckman since he was young.
Everybody was in kind of shock because he was a young man. He took care of his grandparents for a long time, and we respected the boy.
But Heckman had his demons. This wasn't the first time he'd threatened his girlfriend's life. He was convicted of assaulting her in 2016. In 2017, she said he kicked and strangled her. Troopers report that his girlfriend is home with her family now and safe. Heckman's family kept trying to call him as he hid in the woods from law enforcement, but he wouldn't pick up his phone.
There's nothing we can really, no real answers for had happened.
For now, Kelly's looking forward to the village's recovery. He hopes the Lower Kuskokwim School District sends a counselor. He says the kids went ahead with a village carnival as planned on Friday night, and they competed in foot races and won prizes. The troopers did not attend. They were delayed leaving Pilot Station due to weather and spent at least some of their time securing their crime scene, keeping watch over Heckman's body in the woods. Now the Alaska Bureau of Investigations is involved in the incident. Representatives arrived in Pilot Station on Friday to conduct the on-scene investigation, and Heckman's remains have been flown to Anchorage for an official autopsy. In Bethel, I'm Teresa Kotsarilis.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, mixing science with traditional knowledge to give elders access to their most important foods.
There's going to be a taste test in the end for the elders over there to get their seal of approval on our seal oil.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta Subsistence Regional Advisory Council will discuss possible federal subsistence fish and shellfish proposals and other subsistence-related issues and invites public participation at a meeting March 14th and 15th, starting at 9 a.m. at the AVCP Regional Housing Authority Conference Room in Bethel. More at 800-478-1456. This message is sponsored by the Office of Subsistence Management.
Iditarod musher Yor Olsom was the first to arrive at the checkpoint in White Mountain this morning, potentially setting him up to be the first into Nome sometime overnight. Olsom arrived just before 8 a.m., 3.5 hours ahead of Nicholas Petit. The arrival kicked off an 8-hour mandatory hold before mushers can take off for the last 77 miles to Nome. Bad weather along the coast has made it difficult for media and support crews to reach some coastal checkpoints over the last few days. Olsom told a camera crew from the Iditarod Insider that it was slow going when he left the checkpoint of Koyuk and he had to walk along the sled. But then it got better.
And then we got on the other side of the mountain and they picked up the speed. And I mean, we were rolling coming into Ilim up those hills. And I decided just to keep on going when they were doing so good, so we had a problem-free trip coming here. It was awesome.
Olsom gained his lead Monday morning when the front runner Nicholas Petit strayed off course on the sea ice between Chaktulik and Koyuk on the Bering Sea coast. Petit accidentally veered east toward shore, then doubled back to refind the marked trail. At the time, the area was facing strong northerly winds and a ground storm that severely reduced visibility. Petit's error created a window for Olsom, who passed him and reached Koyuk first, taking away a lead many thought Petit had locked in. Olsom's runtime between the two communities was a little over 8 hours. Petit's, by contrast, was more than 13. A few hours later, Mitch Seavey arrived in Koyuk, posting a 12-hour runtime. There were two scratches along the trail today. Wade Mars stopped his race in Koyuk when his dogs refused to leave the checkpoint, and rookie Tom Schonberger scratched along the trail between Grayling and Iditarod. And this year's Iditarod may mark a generational shift in mushing. The top of the Iditarod leaderboard is filled out with younger mushers, most of them in their 20s and 30s. Mitch Seavey is the only former champion in the current top 20. Most of the sport's titans are further back, if they're still running at all. As Alaska Public Media's Zechariah Hughes reports, many members of mushing's old guard are content to watch a new generation inherit the mantle.
Usually along the trail, Jeff King has a giant tub of animal crackers. But right now in Unalakleet, surrounded by boxes of snacks, he is liberally enjoying a bag of candy.
Meaning a couple of peanut butter cups by Reese's before I go up and have a bite in the community center.
King has won the Iditarod 4 times, among innumerable other distinctions in a sport he's helped define for decades. But his drive to win is diminished.
My motto has been, I'm going to get there as fast as I can without rushing. And you know, I just need sleep now I didn't used to need, or at least I'm not willing to go without to keep up with these yahoos. I'm not physically up to it.
As he watches younger mushers stress over minutes lost in their scramble to win, King doesn't feel envy. Instead, it's causing him to re-examine a notorious reputation for competitiveness that came at the expense of a lot else.
There's even part of me on the Yukon watching these guys just go, why are you, and why did I used to feel so compelled to get my dogs to know them faster than your dogs? Who really gives a rip?
Instead, he's approaching the race more philosophically and compares racing his dog team 1,000 miles to his mother growing heirloom tomatoes.
You know, you don't rush it. You plan it, you nurture it, you care for it, and then you monitor the fruit. In this case, it's the fruit is the energy and the athleticism of the dogs. But you don't pick the fruit until it's ready.
What King means is that he isn't going to push his dogs or himself for the sake of a race position. And perhaps this sounds familiar. Last year, King sang a similar tune when, early in the race, he was solidly in the middle of the pack, yet sprinted down the coast and seized 11th place. Though he's kept a comfortable pace this year, he's looking forward to speeding down the next few 100 miles. But he insists it has nothing to do with winning. It's just fun to do when you've got a gang line full of ripe tomatoes. A single spot ahead of King is one of his main competitive rivals, Martin Boozer, himself a 4-time champion as well. He's just finished a baggie of muktuk, given to him as a gift, and is on his way inside for a nap. Boozer chuckles, describing his slog over the portage into Unalakleet.
It wasn't any faster than the Yukon. Everything seems like going in slow motion this year.
Boozer is upbeat, but there are notes of melancholy. He's had a little bit of fun this race, but after years of jockeying for first place, he says it's frustrating to have a good team, solid strategy, and familiar routines, yet still be just barely in the top 30.
It's just part of the game, you know. It's just one of the trials and tribulations we have to overcome.
Boozer and King haven't said anything about not running future Iditarods. But that isn't the case for Didi Jonro, one of mushing's most vibrant celebrities. She announced a while back that she'd be retiring from competition, then scratched early in this year's race.
My personal health had gotten to the point where dog care could possibly be compromised, and that's not who I am, that's not who I want to be, and quite frankly, I think I could have been a burden.
Jonro flew to Unalakleet to stay with friends, greet peers at the checkpoint, and start enjoying the race from a new vantage point.
I thought it could possibly be kind of sad, wish I was on a team. It is not. It feels good on this end.
Jonro says she'd like to spend the next few Iditarods as a volunteer at the checkpoint in Unalakleet. On the Iditarod Trail in Unalakleet, I'm Zechariah Hughes.
As the first Iditarod mushers close in on Nome, fans are following the race obsessively, and not just in Alaska. The race has followers around the country, and mushers' progress is sometimes tracked in elementary school classrooms. These days, it's also tracked in the halls of the U.S. Senate. One hallway, to be specific. Alaska Public Media's Liz Bruskin has this scene from just outside Senator Lisa Murkowski's door in the Hart office building.
It's just after lunch, and there's a crowd in the hallway leading to the offices of Murkowski and Illinois Senator Tammy Duckworth. Right between their doors, Murkowski staffers have put a map of the Iditarod Trail. It's mounted on poster boards sitting on an easel. A group from Chicago doesn't know what to make of this display with its neon arrows and a leaderboard with unfamiliar names.
So you guys have never heard of the Iditarod?
No.
No.
Never.
No. Explain it.
They're from the National Association of Postal Supervisors, waiting to meet with Senator Duckworth. One of them knew something about the Iditarod.
Sled race, dog race, from one place to the other, yeah.
With a little explanation, the postal supervisors are intrigued. They ponder the map, showing Norwegian Jor Olsom is ahead.
How would you let someone come in from Norway?
How does that happen?
That's what we're
wondering.
Wow.
Yeah. How is that happening?
How does that happen?
How? That happened Monday on the Bering Sea ice. And it was right around the time Murkowski staffer Devin O'Brien took the poster board down to update it.
Excuse me?
O'Brien logged on to Iditarod.com and pulled up the GPS tracker. She noticed something curious. It looked like Nick Petit of Girdwood had hardly moved since the last update.
It looks like Yor is actually ahead, so I'll move his.
O'Brien would later learn this was a pivotal moment in Iditarod 2018, when Petit had gone off course and had to backtrack, giving the lead to the Norwegian. Murkowski Press Secretary Hannah Ray says the board builds camaraderie in the office.
Check it. Even now their offices are asking us about it, about, well, have you updated it today? Or what are the standings? People who probably didn't know anything about the Iditarod before this was out are buzzing about it.
Ray says she's talked to people who only know the story of the 1925 serum run to Nome through the animated movie Balto.
I had someone say that they had no idea that was a true story. And so to hear them coming and asking questions about Alaska history is really cool.
Murkowski's office says the map will be up until the last musher reaches Nome. Reporting from the Hart Senate Office Building in Washington, D.C., I'm Liz Ruskin.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Did you know while exposed to secondhand smoke, every breath you take can damage your heart? Cells lining blood vessels become swollen and inflamed. Plaque builds narrowing blood vessels and clots can form, robbing the heart of oxygen. Exposure to secondhand smoke increases your heart disease risk by up to 30%. It's your heart protected. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Quitline, 1-800-QUIT-NOW.
Record low levels of ice have changed how the Bering Sea looks throughout the year. Now scientists want to know if it will also change how the sea sounds. KNOM's Zoe Gruskin has more.
They're gray tubes, PVC tubes, maybe half a meter long, and they might be attached to a big round float.
Ricardo Antunes is describing an underwater recording device. Since 2013, he's been dropping them over the side of fishing boats in the Bering Strait and off St. Lawrence Island. He's trying to do something that's never been done here. Listen in on the Bering Sea. The recorders pick up everything in the water, from whales and walrus to passing ships.
We wanted to monitor the current noise levels. We call the baseline levels. How are things at the moment so that we can compare 10 years, 20 years from now?
That's because the Bering Sea is changing fast. Rising temperatures have meant less sea ice year after year. And with more open water, shipping traffic has increased. Both trends are expected to continue. Antunes is a conservation scientist at the Wildlife Conservation Society, based in New York. He says for years, Alaska natives, particularly from St. Lawrence Island, have raised concerns that increased shipping could drive away the marine mammals they depend on for food throughout the year.
Marine mammals are very sensitive to noise, and all this additional shipping in these waters might create an impact by the introduction of noise.
Scientists have used satellite tags and aerial surveys to track mammals in the Bering Sea, but Antunes says a study like this one is something new. One advantage of a sound-focused or acoustic study is that the instruments can be left in the water for months at a time.
Our instruments monitor for long periods, times when everything's covered in ice, in bad weather, good weather, in conditions where it's hard to get out there and monitor.
That gives scientists a record of the animals and ships in the water over an entire season. The project started small. With the help of local hunters, Antunes and his team put in place a single recorder off the coast of Gamble in 2013. Gradually, as they've gained more funding, they've been able to add recorders and expand the study farther north into the Bering Strait. After Antunes retrieves the devices, he can listen to what's been recorded and hear the movement of marine mammals. He says, once you learn each animal's distinctive calls, it's not hard to pick them out. From the rubbery song of bowhead whales, to walruses' telltale knocks. What the sounds show right now, the baseline Antunes talked about, is not surprising. Ships pass through in the summer, and marine mammals are most common in the winter, when sea ice locks up the Bering Strait and St. Lawrence Island. Seals and walrus use that ice to haul out, and hunters use it to harvest them. Or at least, that's how it used to go. In the past, the Bering Sea would begin to freeze around St. Lawrence Island as early as October, but this year, there's still open water in March.
Ice should be at the island by now, and it's not yet. It seems to be the general opinion that this is a very odd season.
That might be an understatement. Delbert Pungawi is president of the Savunga IRA. Born in 1959, he says he grew up with 9 months of winter. Now, he says,
every day, those of us that grew up with the ice, when I look out towards the ocean now, today, I'm in a state of shock, disbelief.
Antunes says it isn't yet clear how the lack of ice will impact marine mammals. Ice-free waters for more of the year could mean more shipping traffic when the mammals are present, potentially disturbing them. But then again, without the ice, Antunes says, the animals might not come down to St. Lawrence Island at all. That is what Pungawi is worried about. Marine mammals mean food security. Without them, his community will have to find new ways to sustain itself.
I've known this was coming, but it's coming so fast right now. I had hoped that it would be some years down the road.
Antunes plans to share his findings and recordings with the communities where he worked. Reporting in Nome, I'm Zoe Gruskin.
There's a traditional foods movement happening in Alaska. Dietitians, administrators, and others are trying to get more wild foods like moose, berries, and beach greens into healthcare facilities and schools. Ann Hillman with Alaska Public Media's Solutions Desk reports there's one food that people want but just can't have yet.
In Kotzebue, the long-term care facility is leading the way with their state-certified meat processing building, the Sigluk. Things like caribou and trout are regularly on the menu. But there's one food that elders really, really want, and they aren't allowed to have. Seal oil.
Seal oil has been implicated in a lot of botulism outbreaks in Alaska.
That's Chris Dankmeyer, the environmental health manager at Manilik Association in Kotzebue.
There's a long record. In fact, some of the earliest records of botulism were from our region back in the 70s.
Botulism is a bacteria that causes nausea, vomiting, blurry vision, even muscle weakness and death.
I mean, it's a very potent toxin. It's deadly.
And Alaska has significantly more cases of botulism than other states, mostly because of fermented foods and sometimes because of seal oil. So serving seal oil in nursing homes and schools is illegal, except during potlucks. Chris's colleague, Cyrus Harris, says that's a problem because seal oil is a necessary condiment in his culture.
It's a delicacy. It's what our elders are really needing, you know, and that's what they were raised with.
So together, Chris, Cyrus, and others are developing a plan to certify seal oil.
And over here, we're working on our seal oil experiment.
Cyrus opens up a chest freezer at the Sigluk and points out bags of slick gray and black spotted frozen seal skins.
My job was to get some seal skins and seal with blubbers. They got the blubbers attached to them. So there's four of those in here, the seal skins and blubbers.
Cyrus has been making seal oil his entire life. He cuts the blubber from the skin, chops it into small pieces, and puts it into a container to let it render into oil. Sometimes he stirs it. Sometimes he adds older seal oil to speed up the rendering. But now, when he does it inside the Sigluk instead of at hunting camp, every part of the process has to be documented. That's where Chris, the food safety expert, comes in. Chris shows me around his tiny lab.
The most important piece of equipment that we got right now is the pH meter.
In order to serve seal oil at the long-term care center or at hospitals around the state, Cyrus and Chris have to develop a food safety plan. It's never been done before for seal oil.
No one's ever really documented scientifically what's going on from the transition of seal blubber into oil.
They're working with scientists from the University of Wisconsin and the Kodiak Seafood and Marine Science Center to figure out what makes seal oil potentially dangerous. They're measuring temperatures, water content, and pH. They're sending samples to labs out of state to document the microbiology. Chris will even film the weeks-long rendering process with a time-lapse camera. They think that as long as the seal oil gets down to a pH of 5 or less and doesn't have any water in it, it's safe to eat. But they have to prove it first.
It's the hot button item that's prohibited, but everybody eats. So there's a safe way of doing it, and that's what we're just trying to prove.
Chris says they've been working on the project for 3 years now, seeking collaborators and designing and running the controlled experiments. They've played with ideas like adding lactic acid to lower the pH, or trying traditional methods, like jump-starting the rendering process with older oil, like Cyrus suggests. But all of those options could affect the taste, so they'll face another necessary hurdle.
There's going to be a taste test in the end for the elders over there to get their seal of approval on our seal oil.
Once the process is fully documented and a food safety plan is laid out, Chris will apply for approval from the state. Then, their plan could be used as a model for other facilities that want to serve seal oil and as guidance for seal oil rendering at home. From the Solutions Desk, I'm Ann Hillman.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We had reports tonight from Rasha McChesney in Juneau, Teresa Katsourilis in Bethel, Zachariah Hughes on the Iditarod Trail, Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Zoe Gruskin in Nome, and Ann Hillman in Anchorage. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Wesley Early is our web editor. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. And by
Northern Air Cargo, providing year-round transportation of all types of freight, from vehicles and oversized equipment to small packages for corporations or small business. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956.
Opioids are common prescription pain relievers and must be used properly to avoid danger. Common opioids include hydrocodone, oxycodone, morphine, fentanyl, and codeine. Safely getting rid of unused opioid medication prevents children and pets from accidental poisoning and protects the environment. Information about safe opioid storage and proper disposal is at opioids.alaska.gov. This message is sponsored by the State of Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
If you would like to play an integral part in what you're listening to, public media is designed for and made possible by the communities it serves. If you are already a member or corporate sponsor, thank you. If you'd like to learn more about how to become a member or sponsor, it's easy. Start with a call to your public radio station. This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.